Good morning, everybody. I'd like to also invite the panel to come forward at this time so you have a chance to get situated. Thank you. So good morning. My name is David Reisner. I'm the Division Director in the Division of Clinical Outcome Assessment. We are situated within CDER in the Office of Drug Evaluation Sciences and in the super office of the Office of New Drugs. Okay. That did not work. I need to get back in, right? All right. Try this. We're in the introductions. So for the agenda in our update in session one, we have four update topics to share with you, followed by five brief methodological topics of interest, some of which were suggested by members of the PRO consortium, particularly the coordinating committee. Here's that list. I'm not going to go through that in detail. But you can expect to see here some comments on each of these topics. The panelists and speakers for our update are here. I'd like to ask the panel to introduce themselves, starting with Robin. We're more or less in alphabetical order here.
All right, great. So good morning, everyone. It's really great to be here. My name is Robin Bent. I am the Director of Patient-Focused Drug Development in the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research here at the FDA, and I'm very excited to see everybody in person, even though I'm really bad at recognizing people from their Zoom photos, so apologies in advance. Thanks.
So good morning, everyone. My name is Selena Daniels. I am one of the team leads in the Division of Clinical Outcome Assessment, and it's glad to see all of your faces.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Lily Gerard. I'm a master mathematical statistician and the technical lead for the patient-focused statistical support team in the Division of Biometrics 3, CDER Biostatistics.
Dr. Laura Lee Johnson can't be with us in person today, but she has contributed to the methodological topics, and we will have a recording of some of her comments at the start of that segment.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jessica Mavadia Shukla. I'm the Program Director for the Medical Device Development Tools Program at CDRH. We are in the Office of Strategic Partnerships and Tech Innovation. Nice to see everyone this morning.
And last but not least.
Good morning. I am Michelle Campbell. I'm the Associate Director for Stakeholder Engagement and Clinical Outcomes in the Office of Neuroscience.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. This is also known as the mic check. All right. We're going to start off our segment to talk a little bit about the COA DDT qualification program. I think Sonny did a great job of explaining some of the activities that take place in the COA qualification program. Basically, it's just three short parts of it. I'll go through the stages and timelines just to sort of provide some background. I can provide our metrics from last year and then just briefly share information about the grant program. So as most of you in the room are familiar, the COA qualification process takes place in three steps: the LOI, or letter of intent, the qualification plan, and then the full qualification package. But we do interact with requesters in between those stages, and that could be review of a protocol, review of analysis results, or the outcome on an advisory board. So those interim requests can be sent to us, to our mailbox, just as you would any other communication. These are the time frames that we target for each stage. 3 months, 6 months, and 10 months, respectively. Those become increasingly more dense for us to review. At each stage, we conduct a preliminary reviewability assessment, and once we accept the submission for review, then the time frame begins. The reviewability stage may take various amount of time depending on the density and also how deep we go into the details, anticipating content in the qualification plan or the full qualification plan, full qualification package that follows. So for 2022, as of very recently, we have a total of 66 projects in the program. We added an additional project since the beginning of the year, so we closed out 2022 with 65. I wanted just to point out the other activity that isn't necessarily captured in that metric, the pre-LOI meetings that we've held, LOI revisions that have been submitted based on a not-accept determination for the initial LOI, and then as needed to kind of restart some of our legacy DDTs that have been sitting. So we've been reaching out to DDT requesters to ask their intentions and to continue and or withdraw so that we have a clear view of what's in the program and what should be prioritized. This is our breakdown of COA DDD projects by OND Review Division. You can see that we have a couple review divisions that I would describe as our frequent flyers, particularly in gastroenterology or neurology. But it's actually a well represented set of activities across many of the review divisions, you know, even some that you might not initially anticipate, such as in oncology or dermatology. In terms of just breaking those down by COA type, the bulk are PRO measures, as you might expect, but we also have representation from all the COA types, and that includes DHT technology as well as what we're calling a multi-component COA, where we have a score that's constructed from multiple components. But those may be a PRO, a ClinRO, and for the sake of being able to cover the whole score, it could also include a biomarker. In terms of just trending, overall, these are our trends, including now the 2022 year. So the total number of LOIs has been slowing, but I would point out that a number of the submissions that we've received in the last year, I guess it would be fair to say, include significant submissions, full qualification packages that are under review or have been reviewed or are innovative and novel in some way. So those increase the amount of time that we need to spend on a submission. And then just in terms of resources, I'm sure many of you are aware that we have a grant program. The due date for this cycle is May 3rd, 2023. The grant number is there for your reference. And then, as some of you may have noticed on the FDA website, we have an update to the program and wanted to point out that we can accept grants as long as your submission is reviewable. It doesn't have to have been accepted by the time you submit the grant. And then lastly, because you have been so generous with your submissions, we are hiring and looking for qualitative and quantitative social science and clinical analysts. So you can send a CV to the DCOA mailbox, and please CC me. And I've included for the posterity the links to the current job postings on LinkedIn and ISPOR. Those will be up for about 30 days. And that concludes this segment of our presentation.
Good morning, everyone. Okay, so we're going to switch gears and move over to CDRH for a second. So I'm very excited to speak to you about the Medical Device Development Tools program today. So the MDDT program is the mechanism for the agency to recognize regulatory science tools. And MDDTs are tools that are going to assess the safety, effectiveness, or performance of a medical device. The program really is intended to provide a pathway to qualify tools so that we can facilitate regulatory decision making. Okay. In terms of what our program receives, we have a wide variety of types of tools, and these are just a couple categories, broadly speaking. So we do accept clinical outcome assessments, all types, including patient-reported outcomes, observer-reported outcomes, performance-based assessments. We also receive biomarker tests, which can be defined as a characteristic of a or an indicator of a normal pathogenic or biological response, and non-clinical assessment models. So these are typically the models that we use for non-clinical bench performance assessments for medical devices. Now, we are aware of a growing interest in software-based digital health tools to assess, you know, devices. And so I think, you know, later on I'll have a slide about our colleagues at the Digital Health Center of Excellence, but there may be opportunities to qualify those types of tools as well. Okay. So since about 2017, when our guidance has been finalized, CDRH has qualified about 14 tools, and about half of the repertoire has been COAs, all of which are patient-reported outcome measures. And so I've just tiled a couple of, or all of actually, the PROs that have been qualified and are being used in support of marketing applications for devices. Okay, so what does the MDDT qualification process look like? There's two phases. There's a proposal phase and a qualification phase. In the proposal phase, we're essentially looking to determine eligibility of the MDDT. We're looking to see if it is a tool that can support safety, effectiveness, or performance of a medical device. And after we, you know, take a look at that eligibility, we would be looking at the plan for collecting evidence and providing some sort of feedback on how that evidence will or will not work in terms of what the agency is looking for when we are looking to support or have a tool that supports a marketing application. Then if the proposal is accepted, you know, and our feedback is integrated and there's like an agreed upon qualification plan, then we would advance you to the qualification phase. And that's really the part where we as the agency is going to be reviewing the data that's in support of that context of use. And if it is, then we would be, you know, proceeding towards qualification. In terms of timeline, right now, based on, you know, the data that I've collected, we've been able to provide a decision on the proposal within about 90 calendar days. In terms of qualification, it really has depended on what kind of a, you know, proposal it is and the nature of the proposal and data, as well as the review resources. So the MDDT program is voluntary, and we rely on agency resources to review those. Okay. The next slide, I just wanted to briefly talk about, you know, since it's a maybe a new program to all of you, what kind of information we look for. In the proposal package, you know, we'd want to have a description of the tool, which may include the concept of interest, method, and mode of measurement. And then the context of use statement should really outline, you know, how is this tool going to be used to support a regulatory submission. This is really key because it helps us to determine how much evidence we're going to need in support of that tool. The qualification criteria, so broadly this would be measurement properties or scientific justification, and then of course the summary of evidence and the plan to support qualification. So that's really the information. We're not looking at evidence in the proposal package, we're really looking at what the plan is and what type of evidence you're planning on collecting so that the agency can give you feedback on that. And then in the qualification package, we'd want to see a lot of the same information. Reason being that when the agency gives you feedback, we want to see how that was integrated and if we're, you know, at the same point with an agreement. And then we would want to see the actual evidence in support of the context of use statement. Okay. So as I mentioned before, you know, the agency is aware, of a growing interest in software-based digital health technologies. And our colleagues at the Digital Health Center of Excellence are really interested in supporting DHTs and clinical investigations by promoting that patient-centered approach with a focus on health equity, ensuring that the technologies are fit for purpose, providing regulatory clarity and predictability, as well as making sure that we're supporting a least burdensome approach, which is very integral to how CDRH does business. And I'm sure you all are aware of and interested in knowing that we have really appreciated the abundance of feedback that we've got from a broad set of stakeholders on the draft guidance for digital health technologies for remote data acquisition in clinical investigation. So thank you for everyone who's contributed and provided feedback. Okay, and this is my last slide for helpful resources. I do want to put a plug in. CDRH is also hiring a psychometrician. Dr. Everora would be our point of contact if you are interested. CDRH is a great and fun place to work at. And then on this slide, we have the links as well as the inboxes to the Medical Device Development Tools Program, CDRH Patient Science and Engagement Program, which is, you know, the colleagues that really help us to do the heavy lifting on the COAs. And then, of course, Last but definitely not least, our colleagues at the Digital Health Center of Excellence. So thank you everyone for your attention this morning.
Good morning, everybody. As I mentioned earlier, my name is Robin Bent, and I'm the Director of Patient-Focused Drug Development in the Center for Drugs. So today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our patient-focused drug development program, and this includes our ongoing and upcoming efforts. I'm going to talk about our PFDD methodologic guidance series. I'll touch on the standard core clinical outcome assessments and related endpoints grant program, and then I'll move on to talking about some of our PDUFA 7 commitments and a few additional actions that we need to take, which are outlined in the Food and Drug Omnibus Reform Act of 2022. Known as Fedora for short. So one thing that we focused on this year in PFDD was really kind of listening to our stakeholders. Stakeholders in this context means people who use the PFDD materials, both internal and external to FDA. FDA has a number of different, okay, it's not as small as I thought it would be, but it's a little off. Okay, sorry. FDA has a number of different opportunities and venues through which we hear from patients about how their conditions impact their daily lives. We have the patient-focused drug development meetings. We have externally led patient-focused drug development meetings. We have listening sessions. And so the PFDD meetings are really unique among public meetings with a format that's designed to engage and elicit the perspectives of patients on two topic areas. One, the most significant symptoms of their condition and the impact of the condition on their daily lives, and two, their current approaches to treatment. Our externally led PFDD meetings, which are similar to the PFDD meetings, are hosted by patient groups instead of FDA. Both of these meetings are public and are coordinated out of my office. The listening sessions are private and coordinated out of the Office of Patient Affairs or out of the Office of Professional Affairs and Stakeholder Engagement. And so obviously that's really complicated, right? And so until recently, the meeting reports from these meetings lived on three different websites, and that meant that if somebody was looking for a meeting report, they would have to know both that a meeting occurred and they would have to recall specifically which type of meeting was held. And so we've heard from a number of our stakeholders that these meeting reports are super helpful and super valuable, but that it's difficult to access them. And so we've combined all of the meeting reports onto a single page with a search button at the top. And we hope that this will make the reports more accessible. We've also and so you can kind of see here, and you'll note that I got really into QR codes. I'm not 100% sure that they're going to work. Apologies if they don't. But, I mean, they work, but I'm not sure that that your camera can focus on them. But you'll notice oh, great. You'll notice a trend through my slides. And so we also realized that it's been really kind of hard for people to be aware of upcoming externally led patient-focused drug development meetings because there is or has been no real single listing of when these meetings are happening. And at this point, patient groups have really held over 80 of these externally led patient-focused drug development meetings and are on track to hold many, many more. And so I think that we realized that this was an issue that maybe people weren't as aware of these meetings as they could be. So we've started listing all of the upcoming externally led meetings on the FDA PFDD website and also listing the point of contact for the meeting in case people are interested in seeing that. And so speaking of our patient-focused drug development meetings, I just wanted to bring to your attention the fact that we do have a PFDD meeting happening next Tuesday on long COVID. The meeting will be held in both English and Spanish, and we're very excited about that. This is our first PFDD meeting that we're going to be rolling out in both English and Spanish. I think it's something we've wanted to do for a long time, and it's coming to fruition. I think we decided that, you know, long COVID with COVID kind of disproportionately impacting the Hispanic communities in the U.S., we thought that it was really important for these voices to be heard. So we have about 1,200 people registered for the meeting at this point and expect correct that at least 600 of those are people who identify as patients. So just to bring that to your attention, it is fully virtual, and we hope that you consider joining. Now, switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about our methodologic guidance series. And so this slide really provides an overview of the PFDD methodologic guidance series. You can see that we have all four guidances now, and they all kind of build on each other. The series takes you from the beginning, talking to patients and caregivers, all the way through developing clinical outcome assessment-based endpoints for use in clinical trials. The first guidance talks about from whom you get input and why. It also talks about how you collect that information. That guidance has been finalized since June of 2020. Fancy slide. We then move to the second guidance. This guidance discusses why, what you ask and why. How do you ask leading questions that are non-leading questions, oops, that are well understood by a wide range of patients and others. It talks about managing barriers to self-report and about considerations for use of social media. This guidance was finalized in February of 2022, so a little over a year ago. Then we move on to guidance three. This guidance three has published since we last met. It discusses how you decide what to measure in a clinical trial and how to select, develop, or modify fit-for-purpose clinical outcome assessments. This guidance was published in draft in June of 2022, and so I think you're probably all familiar with it. We received a good number of comments and are currently working through those comments and discussing how to incorporate some of that feedback when we move the guidance from draft to final. So that is still a work in progress, but we're very excited about it. And most exciting, I think, for us is the final guidance. This guidance just published like 2 weeks ago, and it discusses incorporating clinical outcome assessments into endpoints for regulatory decision making. This guidance focuses on a number of topics, and to be honest with you, the slide kind of oversimplifies what topics are included in the guidance. Because the topics really include constructing COA-based endpoints, analyzing COA-based endpoints, evaluating meaningfulness of treatment benefits, and approaches for collecting evidence to support interpretability of COA-based endpoints. And like I said, that guidance has been out for I think it's about 2 weeks now. Kind of moving back to guidance three, you can see on this slide that these are not, you can see on this slide that we have some resources for guidance three. These guidance documents are not short guidances, and so to make them a little bit more accessible, we generated a guidance snapshot that we hear is really helpful for people who want to kind of quickly understand the guidance. We developed a podcast, and we hosted a webinar in September of last year. So if you have any questions about guidance three, I would point you to these resources as a starting point. And moving on to guidance four, I just wanted to bring to your attention the fact that we will be holding a public webinar that will walk through the key sections of the guidance. This webinar will be held on May 4th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're interested in the guidance, I would encourage you to register to attend that webinar. I know that there is a lot of interest in this guidance, but we're going to hold public discussions about that about the guidance until that webinar so that everybody is able to hear the same discussion. And as with every draft guidance, there's an opportunity for people to provide public comment to the docket. The docket for this is open until July 5th. So now you know what you can do on July 4th. Right after the watermelon, but before the fireworks. So, and so switching gears, I wanted to provide you with an update on the standard core clinical outcome assessment and related endpoints grant program. Sorry, I did not realize I had put, oop. There we go. So this grant program is, FDA has funded the development of five core sets of clinical outcome assessments and their related endpoints for areas of unmet need. When completed, these core sets will be made publicly available for free or for a nominal fee. And so a lot of progress has been made by grantees in the program. And you can see the five programs listed here. And again, the QR code in the bottom corner will take you to the program's website. For those of you who are not successful with the QR code, probably my fault, if you Google FDA and PFDD, you can get to the PFDD website where all of this information kind of lives as well. So no stress. We're hoping to be able to hold a public meeting to share the grantee progress in the coming years because the grantees really are making great progress. A lot of the grants are either completing item selection or starting cognitive debriefing, finishing up cognitive debriefing, or really even moving into the psychometric validation studies. And so we're seeing a lot of progress. I think we're really, really excited about that. And finally, I wanted to speak briefly about our PDUFA 7 PFDD commitments. First, you'll see that FDA has committed to conducting internal training and external training and outreach. The second commitment focuses on identifying and addressing methodologic issues. We'll issue a request for information, or an RFI, to elicit public input on the methodologic issues by the end of June. But to be honest with you, we are hoping to kind of try and get that out a little bit sooner. Following kind of that comment period, we'll generate a document that summarizes the input of the RFI, and we'll publish that to the Federal Register. And then based on the input that we receive from both the RFI and we'll plan to conduct at least two public workshops focused on methodologic issues. Based on the RFI feedback and the learnings from the workshops, we'll produce a written summary that identifies priorities for future work. Our third commitment is that FDA will continue to work to develop a virtual catalog of standard core sets of clinical outcome assessments and related endpoints, and we'll do that by pursuing non-user fee funding for the work to develop the standard core sets, which will be available for public use. We'll also work to enhance understanding of how patient preference information informs meaningful benefit or benefit-risk trade-offs in therapeutic areas. And so as part of this effort, we'll obtain public input through either the Federal Register or a public meeting on diseases and domains of greatest need or highest priority to develop for the core sets of COAs and priority areas where decisions are preference sensitive and patient preference information can inform decision making. And so clearly there's a lot of opportunities coming up in the coming years for public input. And finally, we have committed to publishing a draft guidance on the use and submission of patient preference information to support regulatory decision making. And so we're excited about that. As part of Fedora, FDA will also be working on updating the guidance on diversity plans for clinical studies, and we'll be hosting public stakeholder workshops focused on enhancing clinical study diversity as well. And, of course, I do want to clarify that I have only mentioned things that are specific to patient-focused drug development commitments, but there are obviously a number of commitments within PDUFA 7 that are potentially relevant to this group, including the rare disease endpoint advancement pilot program that's being launched. And, in fact, they just announced their first meeting, a joint meeting with Duke Margolis Center for Health Policy, which will be taking place on June 7th and 8th. And so I just wanted to mention that for you as well. And so with that, I'm going to stop. And I think I'm turning over to Dr. Michelle Campbell. Yes. So I look forward to any questions at the end of the session. Thank you all.
Thank you, Robin. So I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative for a couple seconds. It's another standing room only meeting. So if you don't have a seat, but you have an empty seat next to you, can you raise your hand so people know where there's actual seats available if they want to come and sit at a table? Thank you. So I'm going to quickly introduce to you something that we call the Act for ALS. The Act for ALS was signed into law in December of 2021. I have to think about that because I spent most of 2022 being part of the team to try to implement this. So it's known as Accelerating Access to Critical Therapies for ALS and Other Rare Neurodegenerative Diseases. While it is called ACT for ALS, we do really try to emphasize to folks that it does cover all rare neurodegenerative diseases and the efforts. What you see here are specific sections of the law that was written specifically for the FDA. So it's a law that is for both NIH and FDA, and these are the sections that really fall into a lot of the things that FDA has to work on. And I just want to highlight two things real quick. The first one is this public-private partnership that was selected between FDA and NIH, that CPATH will be the convener of this rare neurodegenerative disease public-private partnership. And I say this to you now because we know in rare disease, and we'll talk about this all tomorrow, about our challenges when it comes to endpoints and how do we assess meaningful change, how do we, all the challenges that we're going to talk about tomorrow. And I say this now because as we continue to implement ACT for ALS and with a public-private partnership, I think we are going to get into some of the measurement quandaries that a lot of us sit down individually to try to figure out, and we'll be trying to pull all those resources together to work collectively. So I think we'll be seeing some more opportunities in the future on that. The next one is I want to talk about out of our Section 5, which is actually out of the Office of Orphan Products. But they traditionally, if you don't know, are Office of OOPD. So they're the ones who put on the big FDA Rare Disease Day. But they also, among some of their other activities they do, is they do a lot of funding of grants of natural history studies, some clinical trial readiness, some different things. And so under the Act for ALS, there's funding that's being provided to focus in on rare neurodegenerative diseases. And so what we decided to do for the funding for 2022, and if any of you guys know what government funding's like, we had to find something that we could do and fund, like, really in a short period of time, but also at the same time, what was going to be high yield and extremely meaningful to us. And so what we decided to do is we put out a contract, a bid, I guess you would say, to look at an actual comparability study of taking the ALS-FRS, which is a clinician-reported outcome that is typically used to support our primary endpoint in our ALS trials, and it's a 12-item questionnaire, and to actually do the comparability study to how can we implement this at home. Because we know, thanks to the pandemic, even more now, we're hearing about decentralized trials, how can we use telehealth, and we know with our patients who have rare neurodegenerative conditions, whether they're a pediatric patient or adult, going to the clinic every 6 months for a visit is burdensome. And so what we wanted to do is really take this opportunity to do that deep dive of, can we do this successfully? What mode of technology is most successful? And really build a standardized method and training of that administration, which is kind of lacking right now. Everyone kind of administers it a little differently. Some groups have trained folks in certain ways. So we're trying to build that standardization. Because what we want to do, and I think for a lot of us here, we say, yeah, this really makes logical sense. We would want to do this, is that we know that what can be assessed in a clinic can also still be assessed successfully at home, and we can still be able to interpret that data, again, because we are trying to support that primary endpoint. So a contract was awarded to RTI Health Solutions, and right now it's in the middle of beginning the work. And so we're looking to look at the different modes of administration. We're looking at feasibility. We are doing early thoughts about translation, cultural adaptation. We're going to focus on U.S. Spanish to start with, because, you know, we always talk about, we always preach, you know, don't think about it at the end. And so we're actually going to follow what we preach and not think about it at the end and build it into the actual process of developing and really seeing what's going on. We're also doing a little bit of a focus. If anyone listened to Rare Disease Day, we talked about how we wanted to make sure we could build inclusion and diversity into this effort. We know there's an effort in the agency to do that, and we know that this is a big deal in a lot of rare disease communities, because trying to get to the clinic when it's 600 miles away for a study is really hard, and so is this an opportunity for us to be able to get a much broader spectrum of patients into the study? So we are looking at engaging our patients. We have various patient groups and advocacy groups for the ALS And it's a couple of the ALS patient groups. We'll be doing a pilot study to really do some of that qualitative work and then the actual comparability study. So perhaps we'll present more on this later as we continue to do this. But this is just one example of what's happening under ACT for ALS, and I think this will leverage potentially some other examples for future opportunities for us to continue focusing in that area. So I'm going to now turn this over virtually to Dr. Laura Lee Johnson, who is unable to join us today. And if I do this correctly, I will be able to, I got to take it out of presenter mode.
Yep. Little video thing down on the bottom.
Thank you. Control what?
It's like a cognitive test.
Oh, I thought you were giving me the code. Escape. Okay, there we go. Yep, I got it right here.
And I'm going to address three different topics related to the PFDD guidance series and other FDA guidances.
So I tease figuring this out. Are we all glad to be back in person, get to see your friends? You know, it's been a while. You know, who's learned their hair longer? Who's got the COVID beard going, right? I mean, it's really great to see everyone.
How many of us put on, like, 20 pounds?
I wasn't going to go there, Robin. I wasn't going to go there. How many of us retired from PHS?
How many of us have to buy new clothes?
How to buy new clothes because we wear civilian clothes. So I think it's exciting. I mean, we're in another packed room, right? Standing room only, wait list. Like, it's really great to see the enthusiasm of people wanting to come back out and in person to be part of this meeting. Yep. All right, it's all good.
Hello, I'm Dr. Laura Lee Johnson, and I'm going to address three different topics related to the PFDD guidance series and other FDA guidances. We were asked about FDA's current thinking on the use of computerized adaptive testing, or CAT, for COA measurement in clinical trials. As you hopefully have read in our third and fourth draft PFDD guidances, there are a lot of considerations that go into deciding if a short form or CAT may be the better route. Papers have discussed this as well. Because a CAT is based on item response theory, or IRT, modeling, sponsors who wish to use CAT should demonstrate that the underlying IRT parameters are statistically sound and come from, or at least applicable, to the population of interest. The assumptions of the IRT model and CAT are tenable, and also demonstrate that the adaptive and scoring algorithms were correctly implemented. Sponsors should consider the concept of interest and if the specific items have sufficient content coverage when using CAT. Hybrid CAT, where the administration of items using the CAT algorithm is followed by ensuring a small number of static items are administered to all respondents, may also be useful. When thoughtfully implemented, CAT or hybrid CAT may present advantages over static administration, such as short forms. This isn't new, we've said it for years. We do have to consider content, and we have to consider if the scoring is true to the patient experience. We heard in the guidance series public meetings and for the decade plus of feedback on the 2009 PRO guidance that more flexibility was needed and warranted. Our new guidance series hopefully makes it clear we are open to innovation, and there are multiple lines of evidence that can support the rationale for using a COA, and that includes COAs delivered using CAT. Now, sometimes innovations such as CAT or hybrid CAT will be essential to a program achieving its goals. What are some of the pluses for CAT? In some cases, CAT administration can bring statistical efficiency and help lower patient burden. It allows for tighter control of score reliability. Depending on the concept of interest being measured and the range of severity in the target population, CAT may or may not provide a significant advantage over a short form in terms of precision, number of items recommended or administered, etc. Now, research has shown that in some cases, CAT only provides benefits to measurement precision on the very high and low levels of severity when the sample is representative of the full spectrum of severity. Consider the makeup of the target population throughout the study, including at baseline, peak effect, and the end of study. For specific populations with a limited range of severity, which is the situation many clinical investigations are in, maybe a short form can be created to target precise measurement over the range of severity expected in the study. However, maybe you're testing in a population where you need precision at two far ends of the spectrum of severity. Maybe you're enrolling across this broad spectrum of disease and need good precision without driving everyone to exhaustion with 120 questions. There are situations where especially hybrid CAT may, when thoughtful, present advantages over static administration. Discuss and align with the regulatory review group early. This is a place where we strongly encourage you to come and to plan on multiple conversations. But we want to be clear, the answer is not 100% yes. It's also not 100% no. We received several questions that revolved around accessibility and inclusion. And we hear frequently that those who participate in clinical research tend to be well-resourced individuals. And we need conclusions drawn about and with COAs that are representative of all individuals living with the conditions being evaluated. FDA's regulation and guidance on this, not just what you see in PFDD Guidance 1, but the Diversity Plans guidance, reporting and analysis expectations, plus oncology, for example, has Project Equity. Yet every week we're in a meeting with a sponsor pushing back on our asking for better representation. So I turn this question back to you. What are you doing? What steps are you and your organization taking to conduct research in an ethical and equitable manner, not just an email signature or blog post? And it's also not just cultural adaptation and translatability. Maybe are you proposing soft quota sampling? Are you recruiting where you can access diverse populations? Are you talking to and meeting with participants outside of Monday through Friday, 9 to 4:30 Eastern Time? When can they meet? What are the community needs? Not just how has it been done, who do they trust? What are you doing? What is your plan? Are you listening to those who have not been traditionally included? We know it costs more, and we know that there are a lot of structural problems and that results may not be perfect, but coming in and saying, FDA and patients, here is what we did to improve access, diversity, inclusion, and that list is long and thoughtful, and you did try, it does matter. Again, we know it's hard. We also might be really uncomfortable. But we all have to learn and to work smarter. Starting from the beginning, expecting and accepting failure is not going to help. We received a related question about the collection of PRO data from patients who may have visual impairments or are unable to read in situations where vision and reading are not what are under study. When we first read this question, we weren't sure if we were being asked about having exclusion criteria related to literacy or vision, then were people actually really worried about consent and costs? So since we're not sure of the exact direction of the question, I'm going to talk and touch on several topics. First, this is not exclusive to PROs. Clinicians and observers also may have issues reading what you put in front of them. Performance outcomes could be impacted. I'll use PRO as an example here, but really, most any COA tool developer needs to keep these topics in mind. There are over 200 million blind and vision impaired people in the world. Many more people cannot read. There are several free, open source, globally accessible screen readers. It is all of our jobs to make accessible measurement tools. The ability to do that at a reasonable cost has improved dramatically in the last 10 to 15 years. If there's a complaint about costs, remember there are also costs to inaccessible trials as well. If you have a PRO measure in a study, why aren't you using an ePRO? Most trials do. Are you thinking an ePRO device may not be suitable for your trial? Well, we want to know, why is it that an ePRO is not going to be suitable? If you have an ePRO and it doesn't have a screen reader and it doesn't allow for dictation to respond, is it that you didn't put that in the contract so the vendor did not put it in there? Some people can't read and your contracts probably need better specs. Are you worried about the use of screen reader and dictation because someone will hear the items and what the person in the study is going to respond? Is it about noise in the background leading to the wrong answer being recorded? Well, there are headphones and other solutions potentially for this. Is the concern international trial translations? The open source screen reader I use has been translated into 55 languages and is used in 175 different countries. It's free, fast, powerful, easy to install, and the open source nature allows it to be easily used in bespoke applications. The inaccessibility of some websites to screen reader users has been a problem for many years and still is, despite legislation like the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. As part of usability testing, you can use these tools for website accessibility testing. Run the tool, turn off your monitor, close your eyes, and see how well you can navigate a website or application. Many programs allow and encourage text alternatives to images so screen readers describe the image. So test your products. And as you're at lunch or the poster hour reception tonight, share your stories. Where have you heard that what was available in the study fell short for the study participant, caregiver, or clinician needs, and how can that be avoided in the future? What questions should you be asking vendors and patients and others to achieve more accessibility and inclusion? And how do you plan to demand that accessibility and inclusion? Many patients, observers, and clinicians like electronic data capture because they can increase the font, change contrast to help their vision, change the font if you're dyslexic, and the like. So you can increase it, you can change it. This is not just for data management ease. We recommend you include these considerations as part of your requirements for vendors of your e-diaries. Free software has been made universal access a reality for a decade across many different platforms, and we recommend you partake of that. But maybe the question actually was, hey, I've got the perfect ePRO. I'm worried about the backup considerations. So what are the alternative considerations that are needed to support patients, caregivers, and providers? Are we looking at recorded audio, something else? And how hard will that be to create? When should we create it? And how costly will it be? Again, another topic for lunch and the reception. And that's for discussion and sharing, and also discussion with patients. What are the considerations and solutions that worked or failed, and why did they fail? Accessibility, usability, and user experience should be the top of mind when thinking about measurement. It's good for trials, for public health, reduces missing data, and retains study participants, and it's going to help with your ADA compliance. Connected to this topic, we were asked for our thoughts on use of integrated voice response, or IVR, and Alexa-like passive listening technologies. Now, there are a lot of different industry examples, two of which I won't call by name to not set up all y'all's room phones. But in addition to the ADA, there are regulations regarding the collection of accurate data and regarding the protection of participant rights, including the right to privacy. And these apply to data collected by any method. Integrated voice response by phone has been used for decades and is well discussed. The passive listening interactive systems can have challenges. Beyond accurate data collection, usability, and the like, there's privacy in general. Is this device passively listening to everything in the space all the time, waiting to be called upon, or is the listening turned on and off? A major question for the passive listening devices can be what, or rather who, else is captured. If you're worried about the non-study participant whose data might be collected as well, you cannot figure out how to avoid it. You also might find that people in the household, if that's where you're setting this up, are willing to say it's okay. Do not say no before asking the people impacted what solutions maybe could work. There are also data privacy concerns with these passive listening devices. Where is the data stored? Where does the data and information transit through? Do remember, people are consenting to be in your trial. The mechanism for data collection can be in the consent. Most privacy laws around the world have special carve-outs for research, so talk to your lawyers about those. Now, some digital health technologies or DHTs are running into these same questions, and they have learned a lot, and there's a lot to share between the different organizations. But think broadly. Many people need accommodation. Remember, the purpose of a COA is to capture the patient's experience. The instrument needs to be considered a credible measure, and there needs to be evidence of its usefulness, that it is relevant to the situation. This is part of what would feed into your evidence-based rationale supporting the COA. If someone is unable to use an instrument according to the protocol, any change made to the data collection methods described in the protocol should be reported as protocol deviations. They also should be recorded as part of the data set that is submitted to FDA, and CDISC has more information on that. So in closing, I'd like to thank T and David for making it possible for me to speak today. My fellow FDA panelists are available to answer questions. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the topics in this session and the meeting.
You felt like you could, yeah, I felt like I could.
I could feel the episode.
I could. So I'm now going to turn this over to Dr. Selena Daniels, who's going to be giving some additional thoughts on some ethnological implications and questions that you guys brought to us that you're hoping to get some answers to today.
Awesome. So I'm back live here in DoubleTree. I'm here in person. So continuing on with this segment, one of the topics that was trending within PRO Consortium was social media and how to use this type of data with COA development. And I must say this topic is not unexpected because social media is popular, right? Most of the world is using some form of it. But the question is, how can we leverage this type of data to develop COAs? And so from a regulatory perspective, we see social media as another source of data. It does have the potential to provide useful information for COA development, particularly if it includes information on patients' perspectives on symptoms and impacts of their disease or condition. And it allows for passive data collection, such as social media monitoring or social media listening, as well as active data collection, so the use of survey instruments, for example. But however, like with all data collection tools, there are strengths and limitations, and these are outlined in the first and second guidances of the patient-focused drug development series. So there's a plug-in to look at the PFDD documents. And at this time, we are still having limited practical experience with the use of social media data in COA development and in regulatory decision-making, and we're still learning how we can utilize this with COA development. And it's likely that assumptions about social media data will play out as the evidence accumulates. However, we are starting to see it being used in submissions, which is refreshing. And it's more being used as supplements to traditional research approaches. So, for example, in addition to literature reviews, we're seeing reviews of public patient web blogs to identify symptoms and impacts of patients And this information has sort of been informing preliminary conceptual models, has been informing interview guides, as well as initial hypothesis in COA development. But there are things to consider when we use social media, and I will discuss that on the next slide. And I don't know if the slide is going to show up or not. There it goes. I corrected it. Okay. So while social media data can provide a wealth, or social media can provide a wealth of data from easily accessible platforms and, you know, reduce the burden on patients, there are limitations related to sampling and the details on clinical and demographic characteristics. For example, there are some sources where there is no documentation of the diagnosis. So it's restricted to those who do not have diagnostic confirmation. And these are all issues that should be considered when using social media to collect patient experience data. There are other considerations for use for social media, which includes choosing an appropriate research design. For example, mixed methods sequential research design may be an option to further strengthen the depth of knowledge gained from social media data. The second consideration is carefully selecting the social media source. Different social media communities appeal to different segments of populations, and the degree of the community's user anonymity may affect what users are willing to discuss. So research social media should examine a variety of social media networks and communities to obtain data that can be most generalized to the population of interest to the extent possible. The third consideration, using appropriate methods to collect and analyze social media data. Data collection methods should, again, address potential limitations of social media, lacking mechanisms to verify patient characteristics, such as identity or diagnosis, and how these limitations can affect integrity and interpretation. The next consideration, assessing data quality. Verify the content and sources of information to avoid false information such as bots. And lastly, protecting privacy. While verified patient community data may be used, in some cases it may be appropriate to allow the user to be anonymous or post under a username, for example, in blogs and forums, particularly when topics are of sensitive nature. So these are just some considerations to think about, and again, we're still learning, and I hope some of this information is helpful for you as you plan to think to use social media in COA development. And I will turn it over next to my colleague, Dr. Girard.
Well, it's so nice to see everyone in person. I've recognized so many familiar faces. I'm going to discuss the last methodological topic of interest today, anchor-based approach. Does one size fit all? So one of the key considerations in regulatory decision-making is the evaluation of how well results of a COA-based endpoint correspond to a treatment benefit that's meaningful to patients. We have been consistent in communicating that anchor-based approach is a useful method for understanding what types of COA scores, score differences, including changes, are meaningful to patients. However, it should be recognized that anchor-based approach is not a one-size-fits-all. There are critical assumptions made by anchor-based approaches that should be considered, such as the appropriateness of the selected anchor scales. And with that said, there are other methodological approaches that have been developed that can be used in addition to or instead of anchor-based approaches. And later this afternoon, we'll hear about one of them. Sorry. And in certain situations, I think anchor-based approaches may not be needed or may not even be feasible. So we encourage people to carefully consider their particular situation and pre-specify the approach or approaches most appropriate for your situation that can help to put COA score differences in the context of patients' lives. And next, I will talk more about the situations when anchor-based approaches may not be needed, may not be feasible, and end with an example in rare disease drug development. So over the years, we've had many internal discussions on when anchors may not be needed. For example, I recall having many discussions with Dr. Daniels alone. What motivated this discussion is that we often see anchor-based methods proposed to interpret single-item-based endpoint results. So we ask ourselves, does it make sense to use a single-item anchor to interpret another single-item COA? Well, the answer usually starts with, it depends, right? But in this case, it really does depend. For example, if the endpoint is constructed based on score generated from a simple ordinal rating of worst pain severity in the past 24 hours with response options of none, mild, moderate, and severe. In this case, do we need to have an anchor scale to help interpret the endpoint results? And my perspective on this is no. If, and if is a keyword here, if you have strong evidence, for example, from cognitive interview, that patients are comfortable evaluating their pain severity with this particular scale, and that patients view each category as corresponding to a meaningfully distinct experience. And then in this case, the score themselves are directly interpretable in terms of patients' experiences, and therefore additional supporting evidence may not be needed, may not be necessary for interpretation. So to sum it up, if a COA produces scores that are easy to interpret in terms of patients' experiences, anchors may not be needed. However, to support the statement, you know we will be asking for evidence to justify easy to interpret in terms of patients' experiences. And how easily one can interpret a COA score depends on how closely the measured concept of interest corresponds to the patient's experiences and how simple or familiar the COA's metric is to patients. And good qualitative data can provide the source of evidence for these considerations. So, when anchors may not be feasible. I'm sure many have run into similar situations where you've thought very hard about all possible choices, but in the end, an acceptable anchor scale just will not exist. I know we have. For example, we have run into endpoints that could be based on events happening within minutes, hours, or days. Does it make sense to anchor? And another example, we may see a prophylaxis proposal. Patients may not even have the symptom at baseline, and any change is considered worsening. So in this case, what is considered meaningful? Is it no change? Is this issue more about the tolerability? And even if we want to anchor, what would be an appropriate anchor scale? And in other situations, when we have globally small sample size, well, we can still include anchors in the study, but we know that the interpretation of the anchor data will likely be challenging, especially when coupled with missing data. So this is where having good qualitative data will be especially important and helpful. And next, I will discuss an example in rare disease drug development. And before I begin, I want to set expectation of my example. So my goal of the example is to illustrate FDA considerations in the evaluation of meaningful treatment benefit, and not to discuss the specifics of the trial design or the COA measures used in the trial. If you're interested, I welcome you to go read our reviews and the labeling. So NDA 214662, Merlixbat, was approved on September 29, 2021, for the treatment of cholestatic pruritus in patients with Alagille syndrome, or ALGS, 1 year of age and older. ALGS is a rare autosomal dominant multi-organ disease with an incidence of 1 in 30,000 to 1 in 70,000. Pruritus, or itching,
is a severe and disabling symptom in patients with ALGS. The physical manifestations range from scratch marks, excoriations, and scarring due to persistent and unrelenting pruritus. So section 14 of the labeling describes the efficacy of merlixibat was assessed in trial 1, which consisted of an 18-week open-label treatment period, a 4-week randomized double-blind placebo-controlled drug withdrawal period, a subsequent 26-week open-label treatment period, and a long-term open-label extension period. Given the patient's young age, a single-item OBSRO was used to measure patients' pruritus symptoms as observed by their caregiver twice daily, once in the morning and once in the evening, on the each reported outcome instrument, or each row OBS. Pruritus symptoms were assessed on a 5-point ordinal response scale, with scores ranging from 0, non-observed or reported, to 4, very severe. Table 3 from the labeling shows the efficacy results from the placebo-controlled randomized withdrawal period. So the efficacy results on the previous slide looked pretty good. The question at the time of the review was, how do we evaluate the meaningfulness of treatment benefit? The applicant's quantitative anchor-based analyses had limitations, such as the anchors included in the study either had no recall period or had a recall period not specific to the randomized withdrawal period. The applicant conducted various anchor-based analyses at varying time points, which included OBSRO data from open-label period. The challenge we faced was, how do we interpret meaningfulness of treatment benefit when we do not have appropriate anchors? The ultimate decision was an exercise of regulatory flexibility that anchor-based analyses was not needed. And the reason why? Large and consistent treatment effect across multiple pruritus endpoint of interest was observed. So due to the randomized withdrawal design, we needed to shift our thinking from the usual that change means some sort of improvement to change in this situation meant any worsening. It should be pointed out that worsening of patients in the merlixibat group during the randomized withdrawal period is not unexpected, because patients are transitioning from an open-label treatment period where caregivers and patients know that the patient is receiving active treatment to a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled period where caregivers and patients, again, know that there is possibility that the patient was withdrawn from the active treatment. So this table from the review summarizes the cumulative percent of patients experiencing worsening in pruritus during the randomized withdrawal period across 4 pruritus endpoints of interest. Now you might ask, the percentages look pretty big, but is that an artifact? Were the numerical changes that different? And we can take a look at that on the next slide. So during the review, FDA performed an exploratory descriptive analysis to examine the difference in the change in the worst daily each row OBS score between patients who continued on treatment, the merlixibat group, and those who were withdrawn from treatment, the placebo group, during the randomized withdrawal period. This figure from the review displays the percentages of patients who experienced various levels of worsening in pruritus during the randomized withdrawal period. And again, worsening is defined as any numerical increase in pruritus scores from week 18. So starting from the left of this figure, approximately 54% of patients who remained on treatment during the randomized withdrawal period experienced worsening, compared to 100% of patients who were withdrawn from the treatment. and no patients in the treatment group experienced a worsening in the worst daily itch-roll-up score of greater than 1 point, whereas approximately 62% of patients in the placebo group experienced a worsening of 1 point or greater. These differences in the change in the worst daily itch-roll-up score during the randomized withdrawal period supported the conclusion that the treatment effect is meaningful for patients. Something additional that is not included in this figure, but it is in the review, is that approximately 29% of patients who remained on treatment experienced no change compared to 0% of patients who were withdrawn from treatment. So, given these large treatment effects observed across multiple pruritus endpoints, we concluded that anchor-based analyses for the evaluation of meaningful treatment benefit were not needed. The observed change in pruritus scores between week 18 and week 22 appeared to represent a meaningful treatment benefit to patients and caregivers. So, of course, I will not close without a hiring announcement. Statistics is hiring, too. If you or people you know are interested in being part of our staff, we have several openings in the Office of Biostatistics and across the agency for quantitatively focused individuals. And we don't have cool links like LinkedIn, so please email your resume to the central mailbox and also CC Dr. Laura Lee Johnson. And thank you.
All right, well, thank you, Dr. Girard, and thanks to all of my FDA colleagues for presenting today. So this is your time to ask us questions. Please do not be afraid. If you are, I do call on you. And there are people out here who know that. Also, as a reminder, it is standing room only again, which is great. When we go to break, we do have available seating. I do see some empty seats spread throughout here. So do try to find yourselves a seat so you're a little bit more comfortable. All right. We have our first question over here. I do ask that you state your name and organization so we know who you are.
Hi. Thanks. Great presentation, so thank you, everyone. I'm Aaron Yarlis at Ionis Pharmaceuticals. So I have a question on the very last presentation about the anchor-based approaches. And I think it has to do to some extent with the FDA's often mixed messaging. So if you follow the guidance, they say, you know, anchor base is important. From one decision to another, you know, in this case, they you know, did accept without the anchor based, whereas in other cases, they might not. Sometimes it depends on what division you're dealing with and so forth. So will there be some kind of, you know, guidance or some kind of document of this approach that one would be able to then go to the FDA and say, hey, you said we, you know, that in this instance we could do this, this would apply?
So before Lily chimes in, I would also remind folks, these are why you want to come and have these conversations with your review division. Often, we really do mean it when we say it, and I can now say it because I am in the therapeutic review division, like that this is those conversations you want to have so that that kind of advice can be detailed to the situation that the individual drug development program is in. Lily or David, do you want to have any additional thoughts? I thought, Lily, your example was great. It definitely shows our many challenges of our everyday. But any thoughts on the question?
One thing I want to mention is that, you know, our current 2009 PRO guidance, you know, that was set many years ago, right? And since then, we acknowledge that many methodological approaches, as I mentioned, have been developed. So I think it's important for people to do explore these other approaches. And we have always been, you know, at least myself, I have said many times in public meetings that, you know, we're open to these new ideas as long as you have a strong rationale to support it. So I will be asking for that rationale if you propose something new. So I think I really encourage people to think about it, and that's the reason I gave this presentation today. You know, anchor-based analysis, anchor-based approach is very useful. It has been demonstrated, right, over the years. But, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. You know, you have to think about it ahead of the time, and does it make sense? Like, for example, the example that I gave earlier, when you have endpoints that occur, you know, based on events that happen so quickly, within minutes, how are we even anchor in that case? You have to think outside the box, right? And utilize, you know, other methodologies like mixed methods, qualitative data. I think qualitative data has it's very useful, and it has been, you know, I have utilized those information in my own reviews. So, and also if you are responding to your question about, you know, a documentation, I refer you to the PFDD Draft Guidance 4.
Thank you.
But I also think, as our next question person wants to ask a question comes up, you know, I think we have a session later today, Selena. I think you're on it with Meaningful Change. I also think that session this afternoon on qualitative methods, I think what you're hearing from us, this, you know, let's think about well-developed, rigorous ways to measure meaningful change, and that it has to make sure it's applicable to that individual situation. You know, I know that's frustrating because everyone wants a blanket answer, but there are so many nuances in a lot of our programs that we have to be able to provide where that flexibility is possible, and unfortunately, it's usually the devil's in the details. So, Selena, I don't know, because I know you're with that session later.
Yeah, no, I think stay tuned for that last session, but also just to add on to what Dr. Girard was saying, it depends on the situation and the scenario and the endpoint itself. Sometimes the endpoint is inherently clinically meaningful in itself. For example, in dermatological clinical trials, sometimes the endpoint is going to clear or almost clear, so you're having that complete resolution of that symptom. And so in that sense, why would we need an anchor? So I think it is case-specific, and like Dr. Campbell said, come talk to the agency, talk to the division, and get our advice in terms of what really makes sense and what is feasible for your particular development program.
Yeah, I can add just one or two things as well. It's always specific to the context of use, and you have to consider that we're looking at what we have in front of us from you as a sponsor, right? So it's your summary of the literature, your interpretation, any program-specific evidence that you bring forward, and so that's one consideration. We don't know what everybody knows necessarily in the context of your IND. And then I would also point out that the long goal is to understand whether the findings represent clinically meaningful within patient improvement. So if you throw that umbrella around your work, then that would guide you as to what evidence you should bring forward. And I would point out that Lily was very clear. They're all, at all these points, it's based on the evidence you provide to us to basically provide a rationale around your decisions, right? Not just by presenting them by fiat.
Well, next question, can you?
Hi, my name is Kristen Farmer. I'm from NIH Intramural Research Program, which I highlight because I want to be clear. I've asked this question of my extramural colleagues as well. So I want to pull together a few threads about PRO development that you all are funding, which NIH is funding as well, or COA development, and the ePRO, so especially ones using the CAT. And the thing that we have run into is thinking about the maintenance of those instruments later on, because with surveys and questionnaires, it's you add it up, right? But with CAT, it's a little more intensive. There's usually software involved. Are you thinking in your funding mechanisms about the future and how these things are going to be maintained moving forward, especially with respect to accessibility, and who's going to be able to use these and maintain the scoring mechanisms later?
Well, I'm going to really quickly repeat what was said because I think some people were unable to hear it. So the question was about in our current, and the question's going to go to Robin, our current funding mechanisms for development of COAs, have we thought about, I guess, post-development work in the future of how revisions and the post-implementation and updating of these measures are being thought about in these grant applications, particularly regarding maybe scoring or the use of technology such as CAD or maybe electronic data capture? I think that was the question. And Robin, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Sure. So we did think about that, and so one of the things that we put into the funding opportunity announcement was, and into our scoring algorithm for when the grant was reviewed, was the was a plan for kind of sustainability. And so, and part of our, it's a transition mechanism, and so the sustainability plan is also important. It's one of the reasons why when we talk about the grant program, we talk about the measures being available for either free or for a nominal fee, and we're hoping that that nominal fee if there will kind of cover that ongoing maintenance. And so that's how we kind of considered it. Of course, the devil's in the details, and we'll see how it happens as time moves forward, but we did try to kind of plan for that somewhat.
Thank you, Robin. And our next question?
Hi, my name is Michaela Schultz. I'm from Otsuka Pharmaceuticals.
Michaela, can you talk a little bit more into the microphone, please?
Sure.
Thank
you. Can you hear me better? Okay. Michaela Schultz, Otsuka Pharmaceuticals and Regulatory Affairs. And my question is really about balancing the statistical principles and strength of the analysis, where as a sponsor organization, we've spent a lot of time building up our biometrics group to really focus on pre-specifying a primary endpoint. But as we focus on trying to understand clinically meaningful change, we need to do additional responder analyses, as you're describing. And so how and when can we pre-specify those? Do they need to be pre-specified? And how does that pre-specification come into play in your review and assessment of that data?
Lily, you want to take a stab?
Maybe I can start, and then I'll ask David to chime in. Maybe I need some clarification regarding what you mean by responder analysis. Is it your primary endpoint is pre-specified as a responder endpoint?
So our primary endpoint very rarely is a responder analysis, but then when we look to clinically meaningful within patient change, we need to do a responder analysis to demonstrate how many patients have reached okay. that kind of threshold that we're defining.
Okay. So to begin, I also suggest, take a look at the PFDD draft guidance 4 that's out there. We discuss additional information in there regarding how to evaluate meaningful treatment benefit. But the current practice, has been years from FDA's perspective, is that you start the process by pre-specifying a key endpoint, right? In this case, your primary endpoint. And your meaningful change is really pertains to that endpoint definition. So using, I'm just going to use anchor-based analysis as an example because, that's the most common way. You use the anchors and figure out what amount of change, is considered meaningful on that anchor scale. So that's something that you can, get that information from the patients, and you should be getting that information from the patients. And then you identify, a range. And I say a range because based on my several years working at FDA now, it's really rarely a single cutoff. I haven't seen a single one. Unless it's clear, then, going to zero, that's a very clear cut. So using that identify range, sometimes you have a starting point. Someone may think, okay, a one category change on this anchor, maybe, it's considered meaningful. But you may find out that depending on where they start at baseline, the baseline severity plays into this too. You might decide, it's could be, a range that's like more than one category on that anchor. And then the current practice right now is once you identify a range that's considered clinically meaningful to patients, and you take a look at the treatment arm, within that range, do you see separation? Do you see consistent separation? And then so that's where, some of the responder analysis that you brought up that, could become informative. But I suggest that, do take a look at the new draft guidance and see if there are additional ways to help evaluate meaningfulness. I don't know, David, if you have anything to chime in.
Your question implies you understand clearly that these are two separate quantitative exercises, right? So that's important. And I understand the biometrics group may be primarily focused on the inferential framework of hypothesis testing for efficacy. So this is really a different exercise. So as Lily mentioned, I don't think it's helpful to think about anchor-based analysis, one method to establish clinically meaningful within patient change, as responder analysis, right? We're really looking for a cluster of thresholds because, of course, you've implemented multiple anchors. And we recognize that helps us look at a range of whatever your endpoint is, changed from baseline to week 12 in X instrument. And we look at that range in terms of interpreting whether your group and individual level outcome is clinically meaningful. So I think probably some carryover from the PRO guidance was a heavy focus on responder analysis, and you'll see a shift in the way that we describe things in our current guidance, right? So that's the key emphasis there, is that it's a range, and there's nothing special about the median or the 15th percentile either, right? So you should look at the ECDFs, you know, in a very nuanced, informed way. So it's not a strict p-value type approach.
Thank you. Great question.
Just to make sure I understood fully. Mm-hmm. So this, if I understand correctly, does not necessarily need to be pre-specified. It's a look at all of the data from the different angles and totality of evidence kind of an argument. Is that fair?
I would think you would want to think about your approaches prior to going into testing of those things. So I think, you know, thinking about it after the data's come in would be a little head-scratching. I think we want to think about it early. And I think David's emphasis is really important, that these are really two separate analyses. One is what your statistical colleagues are going to be looking at to support efficacy, and the other piece is really that interpretation aspect that we have. And then as a reminder, Guidance 4 webinar is May 4th. I felt like I needed to plug that in there with this conversation. So we do have time for one more question, or we have two. We'll do our last two. Yes.
Sorry. One quick clarification. I don't want to close this question by thinking that we're not endorsing pre-specification of all of your quantitative analysis. You know, a lot of guidance presumes kind of a linear development. So if you're in phase two and you have thousands of patients, you should do this work and show up at your end of phase two meeting to propose your assessment endpoints and doses that would be in guidance, right? It doesn't always work out that way. So then you're having a slightly different discussion. But if you're asking about what would be prudent and would manage your development risk, would be to work through those questions prior to phase three. So mostly pre-specification becomes important at the time of your confirmatory work.
Thanks, David. Is anyone else hearing a high pitch ring? Okay, it's fading. I just went away. Do you not have a question? I'm just making sure your question. It's good. Okay, I'm just making sure. So this will be our last question over here.
Thank you. So I'm Christine Guo from Actigraph. I would like to ask you a question around digital health technology and the intersection with clinical outcome assessment. We know that you're working on the digital health technology guidance, and also that there have been several digital health technology supported measures in the COA qualification program. And I want to ask a question about the terminology, because that's something we're a bit struggle with when we're using especially wearable sensors to passively collect data as measures of outcome. And this is something we'll hear tomorrow in the heart failure consortium, for example, step count. And we're a bit of struggle on understanding how we can put that in the four current definition of a COA clinical outcome assessment, because in this particular case, it's not really reported outcome. It's, you know, we collect data from patient and analyzing them objectively. And then it's not necessarily a performance outcome, because we're collecting data just in patients, you know, going through their life. So it's not a task. So would like to perhaps understanding how agency is thinking about, is there room to think about a different category in the COA that actually accommodated this type of new measures? Thank you for the comment.
So I'm going to start. I'm going to ask my colleague Annie Saha, who is the assistant director of the Digital Center of Excellence, next, and then maybe David might have some wrap-up thoughts. I think some of your question, something I've been seeing a lot more these days to people, is it boils down to a lot of times your context of use and what you're really trying to do and what is it trying to support, the data that's being collected. And I think that helps also. I know the terminology, you know, but really we're going to start looking at what are we trying to do with this context of use when we're trying to support. Annie, I know you have many thoughts on this, and I don't mean to call you out. We were communicating via visuals, but I feel like you're probably the best one for this.
I think similar to what Michelle said, ultimately it's is the technology fit for purpose for the context of use? And so it's less about whether you need to call it a perfro, a clinro, whatever, but what are you measuring, and are you measuring it accurately and reliably? And that's really what it boils down to. So I'm not sure we necessarily want to make new categories and new terms, but really follow the right development process, the scientific process, to show that you are measuring what you're saying you're measuring, and that that's important to patients, and that it can tell you some kind of outcome that's going to impact or be able to assess whether your clinical trial for your medical product is actually going through. And that's where really coming to talk to us with those specific instances is going to be really important, because then we can walk through what does that actually look like from a verification, validation, development pathway.
And I do think, Annie, the series of public meetings we'll be having on digital health technology under PDUFA 7, we just had our first one a couple months ago. There'll be a series of them. I think some of these things will be addressed. We had a lot of questions from that. David, I don't know if you want to answer, contribute anyway to that, to the thoughts on this.
Yeah, it's a long conversation, but just to be clear, as far as DCOA activities, we have whatever terminology you prefer, digital health technology-based COA assessments / endpoints in our COA qualification program. You heard from Sonia about one that is coming out of the PRO consortium. So we view that as part of our mission to support the development of those assessments. And if they're particularly novel, there's also a separate pathway we talked about last year, and it's on our website, called iStand. And so that's another possibility, which might involve pulling in a broader or more varied set of our internal experts.
Thank you. And Scotty, tomorrow, are we going to be touching maybe a little bit on this? So stay tuned tomorrow. Tomorrow, the last session, which is probably the more important ones, as we continue our ongoing conversations of utility of digital health technologies. Real quick, before I say, hey, let's go to break, I do want to say, and I get the honor of saying hi to the new CEO of the Critical Path Institute. Dr. Dan Jurgensen is in the back of the room. He has joined us, so if you have time, please do go introduce yourself. And he's here to learn about what this great effort at CPATH does. So welcome, Dan, to your first of hopefully many PR Consortium annual workshops. With that, we are going to go to